Welcome to Rolling Start. I am Justin Anukasi and I am your host for this fascinating series. I speak to successful business leaders from all walks of life who tell me about their professional and personal journeys so far, including some of the tough barriers they've had to break through in order to get there. In this episode, we speak to Nick Vale, a friend, a fund manager at Investec Wealth, who tells us about family life, his beloved West Ham United, and how he became a successful wealth manager in the City of London. Nick, great to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us on Rolling Start.
Thank you very much, Justin. Happy to be here. Honoured to be here.
So, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. It's been a challenging time for the last couple of weeks in financial markets, so that's not so much fun at the moment, but is part of investing, but otherwise very well, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your role and your kind of journey to get there.
So my role is acting as an investment manager for a very wide variety of clients, so individuals, families, and everything that comes with that. I think it's a very privileged role. I look after people from working in all sorts of different industries, so it's important to understand what people are looking to achieve with their wealth. So that's part of the role, the relationship management side of things. And then we then put that to work, so the buck stops with me. Clearly, I'm lucky enough to work with a great firm, but I make decisions for clients and so managing their assets for the long run.
Can you talk about your personal journey and how you got to that role?
Yes, of course. So when I was at school, I loved languages. I loved numbers, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And my teachers were very kind and spent some evenings with me trying to explore what I wanted to do. And I ultimately, at university, at Warwick, where we met, obviously, to do with football originally, I read a joint honours degree, so German and business studies. So the business studies part was modular, and the modules that I focused on were accounting and finance. And that's where I discovered investing. And ultimately, the career path of investment management for people suited me because I like people and I like the trust that clients have to put in investment managers. I'm okay with numbers as well. So that combination for me and looking at the world and trying to see where the world is going was quite a good combination. So I was lucky enough to get a lot of rejections, but got some work experience and then ultimately get on a graduate program and train up and build from there, really.
You mentioned the teachers were quite important in giving you direction. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. It was a long time ago. So I had particularly one teacher that I remember him talking to me. And I really enjoyed geography and I was quite interested in that and languages. And what they tried to help me with is not say you should do X, Y, or Z, or you should be a policeman or whatever it may be. It was more that trying to guide me that to give me options. And so business studies at the time, I had studied economics at GCSE. I didn't at A-level. And I didn't really know business studies is a sort of a poor man's economics at the time. But actually, they gave me some thoughts as to my skill set and what they thought might suit me. And that was very kind of them. I wasn't a particularly confident teenager, and also was very young. It's difficult to know what you want to do when you're young, but with the numbers and hopefully they saw that I could hopefully have a conversation with people and be a reasonable person. So they felt that the combination of business studies being quite open-ended and lots of options within it, and then also the language, which is just something that I enjoyed.
I can't believe that you weren't confident as a teenager. But you mentioned about the teachers being effectively role models to you. What would you say you learnt from those teachers at that time? What was the
thing that springs to mind? One of my favourite teachers. He said to me, oh, I haven't thought about this for a long time. He said to me, "You only regret the things that you don't do." And I think that's a really good life lesson. So I always try various things, but one of the things I try and focus on is it's better to do something and then regret having done it within reason, rather than not do something, not put yourself forward for that thing, or not dream big. I think it's better to try and do something and then possibly regret it rather than hold yourself back.
Do you think you could give a recent example of something that you've done recently that kind of abides by that motto?
I think professionally, it's probably not a great example, but part of the job when we meet new clients, often it's a personal recommendation. Quite often it's working with independent financial advisors, and they are giving the big picture planning for clients, and they will introduce maybe two or three or five firms, and so we effectively have to pitch. And so I'm doing a presentation, and I used to really worry about those at the start of my career. I started doing them in my mid-20s, and it's just once you, it's just practice. So not that I'm perfect at them by any means now, but just that much more comfortable, given that I've done a lot of them. So I think putting yourself forward I'm not a big public speaker, but the more that you, clearly the more for me anyway, the more you do something, the more you're kind of desensitized to it. So giving presentations, whether that's, for example, for me, to new clients or to rooms of colleagues or whatever it may be. I think I know a lot of people enjoy public speaking. That is not in my repertoire of favourite things, but you get used to it. I'm not quite as good as you, Justin, on that.
I think you've touched on something that's quite important here, and it's something that when I speak to people who first enter the industry, it's a challenge they often have, is this dealing with the fears that they have. I'm just curious to any coping mechanisms that you have or advice you'd give for people that are dealing with these types of fears.
I think the first thing that springs to mind is to be prepared, to be as prepared as you can be. And I was quite young when I started being responsible for clients' assets. And my boss at the time, my mentor, who was a huge inspiration to me, who I happened to see this morning, he knew that I was nervous, and he entrusted his personal and his family wealth with me when I was 24, I think, which was, with the benefit of hindsight, was truly remarkable of him. And he used to say to me that if you are nervous in a professional or any sort of meeting, just be prepared, and once people know that you're competent at whatever it is, they won't care about your age. So just make sure you know your stuff to the best of your ability, and then deliver. And people, an age is just a number. If you show that you have the knowledge in whatever it is that you're doing, it happens to be investment management for me. I think for me as well, being organized, being structured. I'm lucky enough to work in a fantastic team. And my colleague Peter, who sits next to me, he knows if I've got a lot on, if I don't structure myself, I can get a bit flustered. I love being organized in lists. So I think as well, being just taking your time to prioritize and be organized is incredibly constructive.
And how do you go about prioritizing? You come across to me as somebody who's very disciplined and organized. So I'm wondering how you go about prioritizing, how you go about organizing your workload.
The thing first pops into my head is quite specific to my role, I think. So the first things are, what are the most time sensitive? So if there are any market related matters that need actioning, they have to come first. If again, in my role with managing a lot of money for clients, if clients need some money, then that's it. Those are the simple things. They are, if you do not do that, then there are implications, and we have to provide a high level of service. But in terms of a more general sense, you just have to take the time to, and part of it is experience, understanding what are the most important things. And it's really simple and basic, but just having lists to be organized. I find I have my list professionally is a lot more constructively undertaken than my personal to-do list, which okay, I try not to, but can play second fiddle a bit.
So we met, would have been, I think it was the year 2000, so, you know, a good, you know, almost 20 years ago, playing for a football team called Stroke 2000, right? And it was both a lot younger then, both a lot quicker. I was definitely a lot slimmer. But we both, you know, have a passion for football. I do remember that you dealt with some really quite serious injuries in when we first started playing. And there's one injury that I remember kind of in our latter years, so to speak, which was pretty horrific. But each time you showed resilience to come back and determination to come back and play, why do you think you just didn't give up and say, actually, enough's enough?
I know when the latter injury was the 11th of October 2008. I remember it well, sadly. My ankle was around the wrong way and I broke my leg in five places, so not very clever. No one's fault, just me trying to attack and I'm a defender and it never really ends very well. I think that one in particular was a tough one. Took me 2 years to get back, but I did, and with the help of fantastic a fantastic surgeon and a fantastic physiotherapist. Perseverance in all walks of life, I think, is really important. So I think really that's it. I remember at the time I was at Barclays Wealth, and we had a gym in our basement, which was fortunate, and I was at the gym 5 days a week and doing stuff at the weekends, and I wish I was still at the gym 5 days a week. But I remember just being able to go to the gym, and it was so embarrassing. A lot of my best friends, like you, we met through football and keep in touch through football. And so I think that has always been something that's been really positive in my life. And so that social aspect, I think, is great. I try and have the outlook to try and not focus on the negatives. I try and be grateful for what I have.
When we played football together for years, your mum was often on the sidelines in sometimes, you know, quite horrendous, cold, rainy weather, you know, horrible pitches. One thing we've never really spoken about in any real detail is what was family life growing up. What was it like? You know, how did the family function work in Bishop Stortford, where you grew up?
My parents split up roughly when I was born. I grew up with my mum and my sister, who's 7 years older than me, and my brother, who unfortunately passed away when I was 10. My mother was an absolute rock, and I think certainly at the time I didn't know anything else, and I had a normal upbringing, a good upbringing, but with the benefit of hindsight, and I do think that my mum was incredibly strong. She could have made much easier decisions for herself, but she didn't. And also my sister was almost like a second parent to me. My family was supportive of me. We lived in Bishop Stortford is a nice town. My mum always says it isn't, but it is. We had a supportive family, and we had to be careful with money. I remember things like not having a particularly warm house. Arguably should have moved. We lived in a nice road, probably should have in terms of freeing up cash flow at the time. But my mum did a great job in sticking it out and being incredibly frugal. And really I was the main beneficiary of that, not my sister, not my brother, but me as the youngest sibling. So I am, especially as I get older and see things perhaps from a slightly wider perspective, very fortunate to have that. And I think in my life as an adult and professionally, it's helped me. I think given my job is effectively to be a personal shopper for clients, having an awareness of money. You know, I'm not saying I had in many, many contexts a hugely privileged upbringing, but in terms of perhaps in my job, not the completely typical upbringing. And I think that's helpful for when I act for, you know, a wide range of clients and buying assets for them.
So, as you know, Nick, I also grew up in a single parent household. I don't really have a strong relationship with my dad. I was just curious to know what your relationship is like with your father.
I didn't know my father at all. I may have met him before, but I wasn't aware. I met him when, unfortunately, my brother passed away when I was 10, and I met him at the hospital then. We then had a relationship, not a close relationship, but a relationship for a good number of years. That relationship, we don't really have a relationship now.
Who were your role models and father figures then growing up?
My figures such as that really were my mum and my sister. Until I was entering the professional environment, I didn't really have a father figure per se. But again, I, at the time, perhaps it did influence me, but it didn't do something to me that I noticed at the time. It wasn't of a particular concern to me. As you said earlier, my mum was incredible when she doesn't even like football. She attended in my teens, but also in my 20s, attended football. Yeah, she was our number one fan in our adult football team.
Amazing. Yeah. You mentioned a little bit about your brother as well, passing away when you were 10 years old. How much do you remember of him? Do you have vivid memories?
I think some of my most happy, vivid memories of him are playing football with him in our garden, on the streets, and particularly on the streets where we'd have to move with cars and we get in trouble because I'd kick the ball in someone's garden. And you know, because I must have been 8 or 9, I wasn't aware, my sister probably told me, I wasn't aware that he was letting me score, letting me win. I really thought, you know, this 8-year-old against a 21-year-old had a chance. But no, so those memories are obviously really treasured for me. I remember visiting him after his university time. And I also, he was at university up in Durham. And I remember being up there. But a lot of the memories he was studying, and I spent quite a bit of time with, obviously with my mum and my sister, and some of my memories are actually quite a bit of my time with my sister. and we love eating. I wish I could remember much more. I have lots of memories of my brother, fond memories of Alex, but clearly I wish I could remember everything.
Looking back over your time at home and that family time, particularly when you became a teenager and more of a man, is there anything you look back and say you wish you did something differently?
I think looking back to that sort of age, I think I wish I had been a bit more confident. When I took my GCSEs, I did fine. I did well, but I think I could have done better. So I wish I had worked probably a bit harder. I worked hard, but I think I could have worked harder, and you only get really one chance or maybe two chances to do those exams. I did do that at my A-levels and I got better grades, which I was really happy with. And then having done that, I had the kind of the dilemma with school of do I go to the university that I really wanted to and a degree course that I really wanted to do, or do I wait a year and perhaps go to the, you know, the theoretically posher or better universities. Not that there's anything wrong with Warwick, clearly, but that actually I don't regret that at all. I think some of my, you know, three of my closest friends, you know, I met at university, and you know, we've kept in touch for a long time, and obviously one of those is you. So otherwise, I think I wish I'd had more confidence. I wish perhaps I'd worried about stuff less, which, you know, is tricky when you're growing up and you're a teenager. And I still worry. I'm still a big worrier, as lots of people are. So probably that's not a fantastic answer, but I think that's what sort of springs to mind for me.
I think you have to be a worrier as a fund manager. I'd be very worried if you didn't say you were a worrier. Where does that confidence come from now?
I wouldn't say I'm captain confident now, but I think that I am incredibly lucky in the job that I do, that I have lots of friends who are doing really well at what they do, but they either are ambivalent about their jobs or, you know, they hate their jobs at the moment. And whereas I genuinely love the combination of the job that I described before, the kind of dealing with people and trying to invest sensibly for the long run. So I think confidence, inner confidence, professionally has come through trying to do the job well and being told, certainly far from perfect, but that I'm reasonably good at the job, and that helps boost confidence. I think it's also just experience that you, as you get older, I certainly feel a bit more comfortable in what I'm trying to achieve, what I'm about, and where my head is at, and the things that my goals in life.
And coming back to that confidence, in the industry that you work in, you've already mentioned that your background may be at odds with other people that are typically associated with being wealth managers. So you must have felt, at least when you started, a bit out of place. How did you deal with that? And did you ever experience, so some people call it imposter syndrome, where you feel internally you feel like a fraud?
I certainly did at the outset. I remember, I love listening to audiobooks and reading, and it's quite often, especially if I'm really boring and listen to financial audiobooks, which I quite enjoy, and people are talking through their careers and they have that, they quite often give that sort of scenario at the outset. I certainly was nervous at the start of my career, and some people were very kind. I just tried to be myself. And I think now the team in which I work, the times have changed. And I think certainly the team in which I work in, we have a wonderful boss, a guy called Piers Wilson. And we have an ethic where we very much try and make everybody welcome, staff, clients, and anyone else that we work with.
I know you spent a lot of time thinking about your team and the people that report to you and the blend of people and how they interact with each other. Just wondering what you really look for in constructing that team.
I think incredibly important to me is having people with their heart in the right place. We are entrusted with a lot of responsibility. People put their life savings with us, and we run discretionary money, so that means that we have discretion to do whatever we want with it. So that's a lot of trust, and obviously we have lots of risk controls and so on. But so to be trustworthy is absolutely key. I think you need to, clearly you need to be reasonably intelligent to hopefully do our job, but you need to have common sense. You need to be able to sense when something's not quite right. I don't pretend to be the cleverest bear in the world, and if you can't understand something, question it and make sure that you get a satisfactory answer, and don't be sort of led along by things. I think common sense is really important. Enthusiasm, everyone spends a lot of time at work, I want to work with people that I'm happy to spend time with. So from a colleague perspective, but also from whatever industry you're in, but in our industry, relationships remain really important. And so the people that I work with, and certainly the people that work directly for me, their ability to get on with clients is incredibly important. We're a team. We love being in a team environment. We have all sorts of different personalities in the team. People from very privileged backgrounds. People from people with all sorts of different goals in life and strengths and weaknesses. And that's actually, as a team, one of our greatest strengths. That we've got, we've got some diverse personalities in there.
If there is one thing that you would change about your professional career, what would that thing be?
I think in terms of what I would change, the thing that first springs to mind is I am not great at switching off. As I firmly believe, I'm incredibly lucky at the role that I do. There is more to life than investing, and I do become a bit fully engulfed in the job. And I think that occasionally, and my wife Maria is incredibly supportive, but occasionally she calls me out on it quite sensibly and rightly. So that's certainly one thing that I continue to try and improve on. Maybe my clients wouldn't want me to, but I think that's healthy to switch off. I think otherwise I work with some fantastic people, so I'm very lucky in that regard. I had to make some choices in the past that were tough. I changed firms once. The role of investment manager has evolved, and a lot of my specific role, you either manage relationships or you manage investments, and I have the luxury of doing both, I think, and certainly I was being encouraged to choose sides. And so I think that question for me, because of, as I mentioned before, that I like doing the numbers side of things and looking at the world, but I like understanding what's the point that we're helping people. So I like understanding the clients and having that relationship over time. So I think if you'd asked that question and I chosen the route of just doing the investments or just doing the relationship, I think I would be saying I wish I'd stuck to doing both, because for me, with my personality, I think that works really well.
One thing I'd say is, as a fund manager, you are right. Your clients don't want you to switch off. Although it is a negative on one side, it's very much a positive on the other side, because markets never stop, right? So they're ongoing all throughout the night, and I'm exactly the same as you as an investor. It's very difficult to switch off. But I suppose, how do you switch off? What are the avenues that you use to try and get away from it?
In terms of switching off, I think it certainly evolved with time. I still play football, and as those that play with me know, I'm not very good. So I think switching off with friends, with family, is really important. Increasingly with age, I now do Pilates, which I never used to do and would have laughed at if you told me 15 years ago that I'd end up doing Pilates. But trying to do stuff, I guess, physically to switch off, and trying to do stuff mentally to switch off as well, whether that's reading or especially not just reading my usual sort of economist FT, reading something a bit more extracurricular.
There will be a lot of people who grew up in a similar environment to you, have similar backgrounds, and will be desperate to get into the investment management or wealth management industry. What advice would you give to somebody starting up now?
I lived in Germany for a year when I was at university, and having done a tiny bit of experience in the investment management industry beforehand, I decided to study for half the year and try and work for half the year. And I ended up working for a chemicals firm. I wanted to work in the finance department of a non-financial firm to see whether it was the finance I liked or sort of specifically in investment management and in the city. I did not like it. But I think when I was trying to get an internship in Germany, and it's one of the things I'm most proud of having achieved in terms of getting it in a different language, I applied for 50 internships, I think, and I got 49 rejections. And so perseverance, you just got to get rejections, try and get feedback, and keep going. I've certainly had some luck in my career and life, and you need some luck. So I think that just keep going. If you know what you want to achieve, and I think it's really good. I like the weekend or when I'm on holiday, particularly spending a bit of time thinking about my longer term goals and reflecting on those. Am I undertaking the right steps to get to those? So I think when you've got a long term goal and dream big, I think it's could be quite daunting to think about how are you going to get there. And so I think in terms of trying to build in blocks to how to get there, I quite like doing that works for me. And then in terms of how I've progressed my career thus far, and hopefully I'm nowhere near the end, there's no secret. I think I am doing my best to my abilities at my job. I think there is, for me personally, nothing better than just trying to work hard. I know you're an incredibly hard worker. Being communicative is really, really important. You know, keep in touch with those people that you work with. I think if you are enthusiastic, have empathy, and just care and do your best, that's worked for me.
Very valuable advice. Who has been the biggest inspiration in your life?
I think personally, the three ladies, if you exclude my cat, in my life, my wife, Maria, my sister, Amanda, and my mum, have given up a lot for me, so I'm hugely appreciative for them. And I think professionally, my mentor who gave me my break, who taught me an awful lot of things, big picture things about life, about doing your work the right way, and smaller picture. I remember Rodney Dartnell, my boss when I started my career, he never shouted at me, but he once, I remember it as if it was yesterday and it was, you know, a long time ago, I made a mistake in a spreadsheet for a second time. And he just said to me, "I do not expect that of you, Nick." And it felt like a dagger to my heart. But I owe an awful lot of my career to him. And whether it's things that my colleagues laugh at me now, where I read something in some text that says, "This is our investment plan for you going forwards." And I get incredibly upset about the words "going forwards" because they're completely redundant in my mind. So whether it's a big thing, important thing, or kind of a small thing like that to most people, yeah, he was a fantastic figure for me. But also sort of in terms of more recent times, my boss Piers is the most emotionally intelligent person that I know. He's incredibly caring. And so that EQ he's a real role model. And lastly, and definitely leastly, or maybe not, is you. We try and have breakfast meetings these days, and I hugely value those, and having time to reflect and think about the future.
Thinking about the industry, and there's a lot of talk about diversity and inclusion. You mentioned something that's actually really important when thinking about inclusion is the focus of the industry on IQ rather than EQ. And I do find the best managers do have a higher level of EQ. That makes sense because they need to be able to relate to people. What would your thoughts be on diversity and inclusion in the industry as a whole? And actually, what does inclusion really mean to you?
The industry continues to have a major problem that it's not diverse enough in all sorts of different ways. For example, the man I mentioned earlier, Philip Fleur, happened to be black, and I can't think of in the firms of which I've worked many, if any, investment managers that are black, for example, and that's, you know, that's just not good enough. I think that, and in even in our team, and we are quite a diverse team, but in our team of 10 investment managers, we have 2 female investment managers, and that's not, you know, not right either. And it's a complex issue, and I've sort of been thinking about today's chat. I spoke with a couple of friends who. From different ethnic backgrounds, and they both said professionally they've never experienced any racism, but I don't know whether that, you know, it's kind of active and less obvious. But I think, but in all sorts of different ways in terms of diversity and inclusion, there's a lot more that we need to do. I think that something that, for example, Investec are pretty good at is social mobility. So we work with a charity called Arrival Education, they provide a really important role and social mobility is something that's very important to me. I think that, you know, it doesn't matter where you're from, what your sexual orientation is, whatever it is, it just, you know, you want to work with the best possible people in whatever job it is. So I think that there's social mobility side. I passionately believe there's lots more we can do, but it's an interesting one as well in terms of positive discrimination. I think someone that I've worked with more recently, Namdi Amako, who I hired a year or so ago, and he's training up to become an investment manager, and he happens to be black, but it's completely irrelevant that I hired him because he is an intelligent, ambitious, infectious young man who I think's got an amazing future ahead of him. Where he happened to grow up, you know, details about his skin colour or, you know, sexual orientation or whatever it may be, are completely irrelevant. And so I think you know, we've in the industry we've got a lot to do. But for me, inclusion just means trying to.
Thanks so much, Nick. That was absolutely fantastic and inspiring conversation. I hope you all enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. If you've been inspired by Nick's story, which was a fantastic story, please go to rollingstart.org.uk for more information. On the next episode, we have a treat for you. We will be speaking to Bev Shah, ex-fund researcher, now owner of CityHive, a company established to drive a more inclusive culture in the asset management industry. It should be a cracker. Until then, speak soon.